Bob, recovering alcoholic, and a little nervous, so let me shake that off. But I know most of you in this room, so it ain't too bad. You're all my brothers and sisters. My home group is the Lignum group, and we meet on Tuesday nights, 7 o'clock. We study literature, and there's also a speaker meeting at the end of the month. My sobriety date is now January 15th, 2012. This isn't the first time I've been around AA, but that's what my date is today. And I'm just grateful for that day, like you wouldn't believe. And hopefully I can relate that, tell that to you guys. And maybe somebody can relate to that in here. I have a sponsor. Sponsor other guys. I work with other people in the rooms. And I'm so grateful to be able to be up here. Sam tried to have me speak a couple times over the last few years, and it's been, you know, an interesting ride with that. First time he asked me to speak, I was getting married, so that was out. Second time, it was my mom was really suffering from her cancer and stuff, and I was up in New York every weekend, so that was out. And then he ran into me the other night down in Culpeper and says, hey, you open the 18th? Can I pencil in? I said, yeah, it's been. So I'm grateful. Thank you, guys. Billy, Sam, all you guys from down here. This is a great group. So I guess should tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now in a general way. I grew up in upstate New York, about 5 miles from the original Woodstock concert. I was 12 years old when that went on in 1969, and it made quite an impression on my life. I can remember the county got invaded with 600,000 people over a course of a weekend. We're a little farming community like you guys have here. So you can imagine what it was like. I put a green wig on and went outside and did this. And, but it really impressioned me. It made a big impression on my life because I was a little country boy from upstate New York and didn't get out very much. My town, I think we had like 1,600 people in my town, very similar to the size of Madison and what's going on here. It was Youngsville, New York, and we had 6 bars. We had the town bar, Hotel Claire, log cabin, and everybody that I knew that was older than me or an adult besides my family, that was what they did. On weekends, you went to these bars, and we lived right in the middle. The town was like a Norman Rockwell town is how I could explain it best. It really was so beautiful and a great place to live and grow up in as a country boy. And but drinking was a way of life. On weekends, I could hear, we didn't have air conditioning, and then you have the windows open, and on weekends, you could hear the cars, and there was accidents, terrible, terrible accidents from people drinking and then driving. But that was, I also, when I was young, I thought that was a way of life, too. I mean, people would get killed, they'd hit trees, they'd hit bridges, they'd put their cars in the brook, they'd have head-on collisions in town. And people would talk about it like it was no big deal. Alcohol first came in my life. I was pretty young. About 5, 6 years old is what I can recollect. Very small. And I remember my parents. In their house, they would have highballs. And it would only be on a special occasion that there would be highballs. I can remember where the bottle of alcohol was and the stuff that they made it with. And my grandfather would come over. They would sit. And they would have a highball. Or there would be some black label beer in the refrigerator downstairs. Now, on a big day that might be New Year's or a Christmas party at the house, I got to clean up the drinks as a young kid. And, of course, I got to take a sip. And that was where it started out for me. Because right then, I always thought alcohol was something special. As kids, my friend Jed, his mom, dad owned the general store on the corner. We used to steal the beer out of the store, and it was warm where they had it stored in the back, and we'd take it up to our tents up in the woods, and we'd drink and get drunk and just do stupid kid stuff. And that's how my drinking started out. As I became more in my teens, and the Woodstock Festival had passed through, and it left some of the merry men that were up there, you know, stuck around the area. And so there was a lot of influence of different types, elixirs on the side. So I started to experiment with that at a young age. And I thought that was cool. All I wanted to do, I loved rock music back then. The first time I heard rock and roll, I absolutely fell in love with it. And I still love it to this day. And so that's all I wanted to do, rock music, and try to follow that generation from 1969. I did all kinds of odd jobs. I did haying as a young boy. And the big deal, at the end of the day, I think why I liked haying, it was physical, but at the end of the day, you got to go to that barn. And in the barn, up there, they had Applejack. And Applejack is what they made out of hard cider. They scraped the alcohol off. And you got to drink some really crappy beer and that Applejack. And that's the only reason I hayed. It wasn't because of the money, because I liked to work. It was because what was in that barn at the end of the day. And I can remember, you know, being 15 years old, 14 years old, stumbling down to my house, down from the farm up the road. And always trying to control alcohol. From the minute I started drinking it, I was always about trying to control it, whether it was beer. Beer was a hassle for a while. I had to become accustomed to be a beer drinker. You know, when you get those suds that kind of come up in your throat, and then you got to swallow them down because you didn't want to get sick in front of your buddies. And so that was some work there to do that. And so, I don't know, I was about 16, 17, and I started drinking in school at noontime. We'd go out, and we were allowed to leave the school property and stuff. My buddies had cars, and I was telling a couple of my friends that we'd go out at noontime and over to another town, and we'd have some of those elixirs on the way over to the other town. We'd buy hard cider and smoked eels at noontime, and get pretty messed up and come back and, you know, open the car doors and all the smoke rolled out so everybody in school could see what we're doing. And I think I've made, you know, kind of guys got an idea of who I was hanging out with in school and what my life was like. My father hardly ever drank at all. I can remember seeing my dad drink once or twice. And he told me he saw what was going on when I was young, at the teenage years. And he said to me, he says, you know, you don't want to mess with that. It's in our family. My dad died of it, which I never knew, my grandfather on his side. He says, you know, he used to be in the garage, and he would drink alcohol in the garage, whatever kind of alcohol was around the garage. Not the kind that you buy in stores, but something that was in a garage. He says it killed him, you know. I didn't listen to any warnings. I was always the guy that was going to outsmart everything, do it my own way. I was going to plow the new path, and I ended up where I ended up because of a lot of my decisions in my life. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. Like I said, I thought alcohol was a way of life. This was part of my learning curve. I'm the oldest in a family of, we had three kids and my mom and dad, but a very large family in the area. So if you got in trouble, by the time you got home, that trouble was known about by the time you got home. It was that kind of country town. And I can remember my first real knockdown, fallout, drunk. We were trying to impress some girls. All you had to have up there was a hunter safety license, and you took that and you crossed out and you changed the date on it. That was your proof. You could go buy alcohol, sit in any of the bars. And so I did that, and I went and we picked up some Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. And that was, and I was going to show everybody how to drink that stuff, and I did. I got pretty drunk, and I remember my mom that night, I was hanging over the toilet bowl, and she goes, "Oh, honey, what's the matter with you?" And now the alcoholic lying starts, because I was already lying to cover up the alcohol. I said, "We were down at Jed's butcher shop eating bologna," you know, and I was lying, you know, saying we were eating some of the fresh sandwich meat that they made there. So I was already covering up my tracks and for alcohol, always protecting alcohol all the way through. My godfather was in the BCI, which is Bureau of Criminal Investigation. So there wasn't much about me that wasn't going unknown to my parents, and I thought it was really slick, especially when they told me they had some photographs they wanted to show of me that they were taking. I was pretty impressed that they could do that. Anyway, my first experience with the law was right before, we used to take our senior trip to Washington, D.C., and we had some of those elixirs in our car, and we were pulling up to a bar, and I was 17, and I said, holy cow, there goes the cops. And my friend Dugan was in the car, and this other guy, Scarecrow, in the back seat. I said, Dugan, you better get rid of that stuff. He said, don't worry, I'll be like Papillon, you know. And everybody knows what he did in the movie. He put it someplace where it wasn't seen. I said, time to play Papillon, which he did, and he dropped it right on the floor, and I was driving. So I got my first run-in with the law. And my dad was all embarrassed, the family, all these things, because I just didn't want to feel. I did not want to feel. And I thought you had to do these things, and it was normal. And I didn't understand how everybody was squares that didn't do these things. So that was kind of my high school life. So I didn't go on a Washington trip. Missed out. That's one of the first things that alcohol and drugs took away from my life. And the people in my class still talk about that trip like, oh, yeah, it was such a great trip. And, you know, and who knows, maybe it was just meant not to be. But I had many things in my life that I gave away for alcohol and drugs. It really was. That was one of the first ones that I can really put my finger on. So I made up my mind when I was in high school and senior. I definitely didn't want to go to college. I was pretty sick of school. I was the kind of guy that I could do the work, but I was very lazy because I just wanted to party at that point, 17, 18. That was my life, and I just wanted to get out of school, you know, and after that I really had no plans, but I just wanted to get out of there. I knew I didn't want to go to school anymore, and so I didn't have college in mind, and I watched all my friends going through all the steps to go, you know, they were going to Syracuse University and all these places. They were going to make something out of life, and I put in my yearbook, World Traveler. That's what I was going to be, and I don't know whether I intended on following the Rainbow Children around or what I was going to do. But that was kind of the idea that I had at the time. And I thought that was a good one. Then I met this Marine recruiter. And I said, ah, there is the answer. He says, I'll send you traveling, son. Okay. And so anyway, I went to the Marine Corps for 4 years. But believe it or not, there was a lot of people that really liked to drink like me and do all the other things like me. So I found a place I could fit right in there. And I did that. 4 years of active duty, and I didn't get in too much trouble in the Marine Corps. I actually did very well. I kind of stayed below everybody's radar. But my drinking, does anybody have an imaginary line that they crossed? I know I did, and I can tell you exactly where it was. It was on Vieques Beach and Camp Garcia in Puerto Rico, and Marines would come down here to do exercises from other countries. And we hosted them. And so there was Australian Marines, British Marines, you know, guys from all over the world. And we'd have drinking contests on the beach. And when you were in Puerto Rico for about 6-8 months, you learned how to drink rum. And then there was 151 if you wanted to take it up another notch. And so what we'd do is we'd make Boilermakers, half a beer out on a brewer, and then we'd put the rest with 151 and chug it down. So anyway, the gunnery sergeant had to come down to the beach and pick everybody up and scrape them and put them into a deuce and a half truck and drive them back and, you know, kind of give us a little lecture, don't do that. And everybody was hurting so bad for days. But I can remember that night, I woke up again and I said, ask my friend, hey, do you want to go up to the E Club? We were the only ones in the E Club. Everybody else didn't want to go drink anymore. But I was ready to go again, and I knew I had crossed some kind of line at that point, because my alcohol was no longer just for my own entertainment. It was something I started to really need, but I wanted to cover it up. I was at the point in the big book where they talk about where you change your drink from this to try to do this, the really controlled drinking, and I managed to stay out of trouble and get out of the Marine Corps. And I couldn't believe it. I heard somebody else the other day talk about, do you know what it's like doing PT, you know, with a hangover? And I was like, yeah. You know, that was something I could identify with, you know, really having a head this big and the gunny saying, oh, yeah, we're doing 7 miles today up those hills. I'm like, oh, God. So I don't miss that in my life anymore. But it was all good. And I got to go to some amazing places and meet some amazing people. But wherever I went, this thing called alcoholism followed me, and I didn't know what it was. I just figured I just like to drink more than these folks, and wherever it was, I found a way to implement it into my life and make it fun, whether it was in Yuma, Arizona, or Camp Pendleton, California, or if we were on a cruise someplace, wherever it was, alcohol followed me. And I hung out with those guys. And then I couldn't wait to get out of the Marine Corps. See, I liked this changing things up and never having to be held anyplace. I was a free spirit. So I went home with Mom and Dad after I got out of the Marine Corps. You know, and guess what followed me? I did that, and they lived in Newburgh, New York at the time. They had moved to help educate my brother with some special education down in Newburgh, and it was a college right there. We lived on a college campus. Great place to let a guy that was in my state of mind run loose. And I hung out there and met a bunch of college people that did the same thing I like to do. And then my folks said, you know, maybe you better go back up to upstate and, you know, find a permanent job up there. And I did that. And I went through the electrical trade with some great old-timers. And they would really laugh at me coming in the morning being so hungover. And they would give me the hardest jobs. But I thought, you know, what normal to me was not quitting at all, not ever thinking about that. But I figured if I could work it off by noon and sweat it out, then I was cool. You know, I was ready to go for the next night. And I went on quite a time like that, about 3-4 years. And I still thought I had control of this thing. I was still working on that part in the book. We're at different times, like on Friday night before you go out, I would have some, and I'd drink milk, and I'd drink all this other crap, you know, and eat some bread. I'd keep bread in the car to eat it so I could control my drinking, all kinds of crazy stuff. And because I wanted to be part of Friday and Saturday night, man, that was the thing. And Sunday was just sleeping all day, forget turning a light on in a room or anything like that. My first blackout was during that period. The first blackout I can remember. I really lost track of a lot of things that happened earlier in my life at this point. But I can remember blackout. We were at this party at this guy, High Frank's house. And I can remember saying, somebody stole my car. Going in there, serious, going to call the cops. I'm like, no, man, don't you remember? You left it over here. You left it parked down on the corner. And I did. And I was like really humiliated and embarrassed. I was in there with my girlfriend, and she didn't want to even, like, know me, you know. And the blackout started to become more and more of a problem in my life. And because for me, I had this facade that I actually knew what was going on, and I really didn't have a clue, you know. When somebody tells you what you did the next day, it was pretty humiliating, and like, oh, my God. Hope they don't tell you you ran somebody over or did something stupid. So it was off to Houston, Arizona from there. So I was another cure. I lasted down there about a year, and I was back in upstate New York. Always same trade that I was in. And I was lucky I got into the trades, and I always had that to fall back on. Somehow I could make an income with that and kind of survive. And all my buddies were getting married, and I was kind of pissed at that. You know, because Friday nights were getting slimmer and slimmer with the amount of people that go out with you and drink. And they wouldn't show up weeknights anymore either. Because they were all getting married, you know. Gosh, they were in their mid-20s. Who would get married and screw that up at that point? So I met this gal, and I figured, what the heck, man, you know. We kind of fell in lust for a while, and, you know, she had a little girl, and she seemed to not approve of my drinking. I met her when I was out drinking, and fell in love, and said, great, let's get married. And we bought a house, and we ended up having the kids. But when we moved in that house, something changed in her, because I was still drinking like I always drank, except that now she wanted me to be responsible. And, you know, I didn't sign up for that crap. Married and all that was good, but not signing up to be responsible. I still had a ways to go. And so she started criticizing about how much I drank. So I modified my drinking where I'd stop in bodegas at noontime or in the morning on the way out to the job site. And then I was trying to keep it a constant. And, but man, I was really struggling with that because I could no longer control the amount I took in. I could never regulate that anymore. I lost control. And as much as I thought I knew, you can go into a bar, have one beer, 2 days later end up someplace, you know, and she's pissed, and we got the kids, and we got bills, and all this other stuff. And I created a lot of havoc. And all I was trying to do was create this drinking. I just wanted to do the thing that I've always done. And I told her one day, I called her and said, I can't do this anymore. And she was game, and she goes, I'll get you in this place. So I detoxed for the first time in a hospital. And everybody in there was detoxing from heroin, except for this guy that was straight across from me. And I knew him. He was one of my drinking buddies. And he kind of gave me this half-assed grin, you know. And I figured, man, I can understand why he's in there, but not me, you know. I had the comparisons out. It was Tommy M. And he was blowing up like a tomato. And, I mean, he looked like shit. You know, I was just in there to get a little tune-up. And go back out. Actually, it was April 1st, 1986, because it could always be an April Fool's joke if it didn't work out. You know, that's kind of my mindset with it, because I was too embarrassed, you know, to say I was in trouble. I was supposed to tell my drinking buddies. I quit. So anyway, that was that, and it was my first experience with AA in that detox. There was a little biker girl named Beverly that came in there that night because they said, oh, you got to go to an AA meeting. I'm like, a what? An AA meeting. They go in the other room. So you got the hospital gown that's open in the back and everything, you know, and do the shuffle into the little room and you sit down. So there was Beverly. There was this Abe Lincoln looking guy and he had the Abe Lincoln like hat. And there was two other people, which I don't remember, but I remember Beverly because they had her there speaking. And she told every freaking secret in the book that I had. I figured my wife wrote this girl a note or something. But she told things that nobody else knew to me. And I was pretty impressed. I was kind of blown away. I said, man, maybe this is something I should be listening to. So the nurse was from my hometown that was there. She goes, oh, yeah, here's the AA meetings. Go to these. And I'm like, oh, man, you know, I figured I was being penalized now. Yeah, I didn't want help. I was there for a tune-up, remember? And but I promised my wife I'd go to one of these AA meetings. And I went into the AA meeting across from the police station in Liberty. And there was a whole bunch of guys that used to drink at the station bar sitting in there. And they're all saying, welcome, welcome. And I figured, oh, there's got to be a catch, you know? And then one of my electricians that I knew, Mike, he was there. And I kind of trusted Mike because we used to drink together. He said, oh, here's a cup of coffee and cookies. And I'm like, really? And, you know, and sit down. And I probably had like a day out of detox. And anyway, Mike took me under his wing. He had 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. I used to work for his dad. And he said, man, this is the best thing that will ever happen to you in your life. And he says, you're not drinking? I said, nope. And I had just quit by going into that detox. And I figured I had it, you know. And so Mike took me around. He was one of those guys, the AA meeting guys. It's country like you guys got around here. If you go to this meeting at 6 o'clock, 6:30, if you head over the hill, you can make it to the Rock Hill meeting by this time. You know, he's giving me the lowdown how to get to these meetings. And he's dragging me around, and we got all these guys bouncing around the car, and they're all happy, and they're telling me all this AA stuff. And I was like, oh, God, you know, I figured I'm sentenced to this stuff at this point. He says, you need a home group. What's a home group? And he explained what a home group was. It's a place that I show up every single week, no matter what. They volunteered me to be the coffee maker in that home group. Which they explained what that was. And I did that. And I started to feel better. Physically, I started to feel better. But, you know, they had, in every meeting up in New York, they had these spooky things. These things. Mm-hmm. On the back wall. And while the speaker was speaking, I never heard that speaker. I was reading those things. And I didn't want anything to do with them. I wasn't there yet. But my life got better. I ended up buying Mike's electrical business. I didn't have a drink for 7 years. I bought his business. I did really well. I'd go pick up a chip once a year and tell everybody how great my life was. I was pretty miserable, man. You know, I just wanted to be wealthy and, you know, make some money and, you know, buy new cars and pay off the house. And, you know, that's why I got sober. I got sober so I could have a life, man, you know. And the people were very kind to me in AA. I can always remember that. I thought they were overly kind. I couldn't get that part. So after 7 years, I had been around for a while and picking up my annual chip. And I kept beer in my fridge downstairs for my buddies when they came over to watch NASCAR. Well, anyway, it wasn't the beer that they drank, but in case I ever drank again, that was the kind of beer that they got to have. And I found this little elixir called a roach up on the a rafter in my house one time. And I said, well, I'm an alcoholic. I'm not a drug addict. Let me have this bad boy. So I smoked that. And I said, wow. I wasn't bad at all. In 2 weeks, I was drinking those beers. They were downstairs in the fridge that I had for my NASCAR buddies in case they ever wanted a beer, blah, blah, blah. And I started lying immediately. My wife knew I was drinking, and I told her, well, you know, after they say in AA, after 5 years, you know, you're kind of fixed. And so I told her, I'd limit it to a six-pack a week, and, you know, that didn't work out. 4 years later, I might as well toss the keys. If you go out and drink again, toss your keys out the door. Get it over with to everything you own. Toss your checkbooks out the window. Get it over with right away. 4 years later, this guy I had met in a meeting years before was wading through the beer cans coming into my house. And, oh, man, he was all fired up. He was so happy to have a wet drunk. And I wasn't very happy at all. My life had gone to hell. And because I didn't listen to you guys, you know, I wanted to do it my way. And they 12-stepped me. And I was in a pretty miserable spot. And I was willing to look at these things for the first time in my life. And on the car ride, because back then when they 12-step you, you were out of the house. I wasn't going to a rehab. I was going to Kenny's house. This guy that really I didn't care for at all. But him and this Indian dude, they were 12-stepping me. And that's where I was staying until I got chilled out. So they questioned me about the higher power, and they told me I could not get sober without a higher power. And I started spouting stuff out of my mouth about AA and their higher power, because I was still drinking, you know. And they were laughing, and they were loving this stuff, you know. And so I went over to their house that night, and Kenny says, listen, man, all of us, it takes a higher power. That's how we stay sober. Anybody could try to get sober, but you're not going to stay sober unless you have a higher power. And I had a real problem with God. Me and him, I figured it was God had two rules. He had the people that he liked and the people he didn't like. And I got it. I was on the side of the stick that he didn't like. And so it was always going to be that way. And I was pretty screwed up. And he says, hey, I got an idea, man. Why don't you, tonight before you go to sleep, I want you to write on a piece of paper. If you could ever have a God that you would like, any type, write on a piece of paper, whether it be kind and loving or whatever you want God to be. Tomorrow morning when you get up, you ask that God to keep you sober for that day. I said, all right, I can do that. I promised him. Went downstairs, did that little thing, and I wrote on a piece of paper, kind, loving, you know, forgiving, all the things that I wanted a higher power to be. And next morning I asked God, I told him I didn't know who you are, but please help keep me sober today. So I go upstairs, and there's the Indian and Kenny sitting there, and there was another guy in there. They're all drinking coffee and smiling and happy. And so Ken goes, so did you figure out who God, your God was last night? I said, yeah. And I slid that piece of paper across the table, and I was so proud of myself. And he slid it back to me, and he says, that's your higher power, man, not mine. And so that was the beginning. And little did I know, it was... that trick was in that dusty old big book that I had on my shelf. You know, little did I know that was in there, but that wasn't really meant for reading at the time I had it. Today, I think it's an important part of finding a higher power for a lot of us. And that's where it started out. And I just had to open that door a little bit. And so once I found that higher power, things were starting to move along pretty quickly. These guys were trading me off to different guys every day, take me to meetings, you know. you pick them up, you take them there. And they all got me in this like inner circle thing that they're bouncing me around on. They just don't want me to drink. And so I had been in pretty bad shape. I was suicidal before coming back, and I had been, you know, just in a bad way, like we get in that lonely, incomprehensible, demoralization place. And I was out of options. So, you know, I was having conversations with God at that point, you know. And I didn't know who God was, but I was having those conversations. And so the guys were starting to talk to me about these steps. And, you know, I knew, I'd heard about this third step thing for a long time, and I was reading it, and I was just a mess. And so Kenny and the Indian, Tommy T, they were talking to me, blah, blah, blah. And I was trying to take in what they were saying. And I took that big book home, and I set it on the couch in front of me. I knelt down. I said that prayer, the third step prayer. And I was hurting bad, man. And I told God, I don't know who you are or what you are, but I'm going to say this prayer. Please help me out because I can't do this anymore. I stood up. And it was like a backpack lifted off of my back. That was what I experienced. I can't tell you, describe in other words, that that's exactly what it was. And the feeling was, I just knew everything would be okay. I knew everything from that point on would be okay. And so I got involved in AA, man. Got really fired up in it, you know. Doing the intergroup stuff, volunteering for that, volunteering for this. You know, coffee maker, I always liked the coffee maker jobs. You learn a lot of things as a coffee maker. Here's a coffee maker deal. In Liberty, that was a big group for around there. It was like 80 to 100 people every week, and they'd bring a couple rehabs in there and two meetings going at the same time, and I was voluntold to be coffee maker in there. He had to mop the floor every week, people walking with snow, and I had a resentment with my sponsor, Kenny, that guy. And one night, I went downstairs, and there was a beer bottle in the men's trash can. I'm like, shit, let me tell my sponsor that. So I called Kenny, you know, right away. Hey, there's a beer bottle in here. And he says, the only requirement is a desire to stop drinking. I said, okay. He says, Bob, doesn't mean that they have stopped drinking. It means the only requirement is a desire to stop drinking. I said, so they started pointing out some traditions to me. I would get real upset about, because I was going to be the greatest coffee maker in the world at that point. You know, I was fired up. I had the cookies all laid out perfect. Big urn of coffee here, the decaf here, everything perfectly lined up there. 45 minutes early, the chairs all lined up, the literature out, everything perfect. And these homeless guys would come in there. And I was really kind of ticked to see them come in because they would eat most of the cookies and drink a whole bunch of the coffee for the real AAs got there, you know. And my sponsor said, yeah, Bob, the only requirement is the desire to stop drinking. Maybe that's the only meal they had today. He pointed out to me how selfish I am. Well, I'm not selfish, you know. And he said, yes, you're a very selfish human being, Bob. And and of course, I want to argue with him, and he proved it to me over and over what a selfish human being I was. Moved on from Kenny. We did a fourth step together, and I wasn't quite sure how I was going to do a fifth step with Ken. We were at odds most of the time. And this fellow was at the meeting, our normal Saturday night meeting, and he stood up and he says, I'm Phil. I'm visiting from North Carolina. I need a sponsor. I need to get hooked up with a home group. And I said, wow, that guy's on fire. And so we got Emery, one of the giants up there, you know, with a lot of time as a sponsor. And I figured, well, this guy's got AA. And he had some time under his belt. And I explained to him that I had just about finished with a four step. And by that time, I had it all built up inside of me, man. And he said, well, hang on a second, actually. You know, I'll sponsor you if you want to do this thing. And you got to know a little bit about me. So we had to meet at Pizza Hut every week an hour early before the home group meeting. And that's where he wanted to meet. because that's where his sponsor used to meet him, at a Pizza Hut. And he started to tell me some things about himself and his sobriety. And started to hit a bunch of meetings. And I was like, hey, what about this step? You know, I got all this stuff in me. And by then, it was about a month after I had known Phil. And he was up there, he was writing a novel. And I was pretty impressed by that. And we're at a diner one night, and he says, you know, I've been putting the stiff step thing off a little bit. And I said, yeah, what's up with that? And he says, well, you know, you have noticed that there aren't any, I'm a pretty handsome guy, but there aren't any women around me. I was like, yeah, what's up with that, Phil? And he says, well, I'm gay. I said, oh, I said, I don't want to have sex with you, man. I want to do a fifth step. And that kind of lightened things up. And it was a wonderful experience because the way that man took me through that was just unbelievable. You know, he was old school by the book. And there wasn't anything I was getting by him. And it was a conversation. And we had all the time in the world. We sit across the time. He told me to have a place to go sit and reflect. And he took it as a big deal, which I, for me, it was a monster deal. And he took it just that serious. And so we proceeded to do the step. I went over to a place I used to fly fish, reflected upon it, and I felt good. And life seemed, I was looking at a world through another pair of glasses. You guys all know I wear that Giants hat around all the time. Well, up there I used to wear a hat, and it was way down over my eyes because I couldn't look at anybody through my eyes, just the way I felt about the world. After I did that fifth step, that hat came off, or it was up in the air like this, you know. And that was the difference for me. And he walked me through the other steps. He helped me with the amends, and that was tough. But he advised me that it was not a small undertaking, but he went by the book, and he says, you know, if we see somebody, we take care of it, and people will appear in my life, and they did. And I can tell you I did an amends with my mom by a lake up there. It was something I was really, really scared of, and it's probably one of the most positive things I've ever done in my life. It changed our relationship. It changed my relationship with my brother, my sister, family members, old bosses. After I finally got through that step, it changed things. And I felt like I was invincible. I'm tied in, man, to this thing. I had 5 years in the program, and I moved down here. Right after the attack, I was hired by a company in D.C. Everybody was pushing me, go for it, man, you know, do it. And I was scared. I decided I had a little contracting business, and it was rough shape after trying to bring it out of the weeds after I had my drinking spree. And so I was barely making it. And so I said, what the heck? Entertained it. I came down for the interview. They hired me. And I said, cool. And I didn't know anything about D.C. or Northern Virginia. I'm coming from a little country town in upstate New York. I come down in my little beat-up van, and I said, well, the night before, first day of work, and I said, well, let's find a place and stay. And I ended up in Dumfries in a hotel, and because that was the first place I pulled off. And I said, well, I'll just hook up with AA while I'm down here. I could not believe how many people were up at 5 o'clock in the morning, man, when I got on that freeway for the first time. I could not believe it. You know, it blew my mind. And, you know, and they all took it for granted being in a traffic jam at 5 o'clock in the morning, six lanes and people bumping into each other, you know. Nobody was up in my town at that time unless they were turkey hunting in the morning or something, you know. So it was a culture shock. And I was prepared to get rid of my business. I had to get this security clearance thing, which I didn't know anything about. But, oh, well, I can do that. And I'm staying in this hotel in Dumfries. I have like $500 I bought with me. And it's 2 weeks before Christmas. I believe right around that time, 2 or 3 weeks before Christmas. And I was informed by my employer that they hold the first 2 weeks' pay. I'm like, wow. And I've been going up to the clubhouse up there in Northern Virginia and announcing that I need a place to stay, blah, blah, blah. Just moving here, looking to get settled in. And everybody's like, yeah. I met this one guy, Rob, who was really trying to help me out. And he's taking me around. Yeah, this guy needs a room. So I'm burning through this money, you know. And I'm finding out I don't have another paycheck coming. It's Christmas time. I know some people up north owe me money. And I'm pretty miserable. But by now, I know God's will. So, you know, I've got a little experience in AA. And I'm packing my bag before Christmas. Broke, can't find a room. Going home for Christmas, like, at least I know up there I can still do my stuff. And still do my electric work in the crappy little house in the little town. I'm not going to be the big shot. And I was like, okay, God, I get it. And I remember packing that suitcase. You don't want me here. I know it, you know. Telling him his will. And packing it up and throwing it in that car. And I remember driving up over the border between Maryland and Pennsylvania. And it was snowing. It was miserable. And I was just barreling up that 81 to get home. And phone rings. I say, hey, Bob, it's Rob. I say, hey, Rob, what's up? And he's, not much. I say, hey, man, I'm letting you know that I'm probably not coming back. I'm done, buddy. And he says, oh, man. He says, don't you worry about that. He says, we had one of our roommates move out, and it was a bunch of sober people, and you got a place to live. And I said, I'll drive back, Rob. How much money do you want? He says, no, I don't want nothing, man. Go have Christmas with your family. He says, come see me when you get back. About $350 a month. Wow. You know, that's right after I got done telling God. I understood what he wanted. Got that mysterious little phone call. And I've had a lot of those experiences since I've been in this program. And I'm rambling on. I became a world traveler. Went through a divorce, which was difficult, a difficult part of my life. And I got too good for y'all. And I started believing the BS that's on the left side of my head, talking to the right. And I was a real big shot. And I had arrived. I don't know if you guys ever heard that any place before. But I had arrived. And I picked up a drink. And I can make up a million excuses, just like it says in the book. And they seem plausible, but they're not. I'm an alcoholic. I am the real deal. And I went back out again. And this was after 12 years of sobriety. And I knew I was going to drink. I was too embarrassed to go into a room full of alcoholics because I had this time, which I thought was just so precious, and say that, hey, man, I think I'm going to pick up a drink. I had too much of an ego to say that, and I knew it. I knew it for a long time. And I wasn't about to go into a room with people with under a year and say, I think I'm about to pick up a drink. And it was eventual, and I did. And then I went through spats of sobriety. My disease had progressed in me, just like you told me it would. And I'd get 6 months. I'd get a year. 4 months. You know. And then I ended up on New Year, on Thanksgiving, going up upstate New York to pick up my poor mom to come down and spend some time with us. And I had a car wreck. And Ruth was living with me, my wife today, at the time, and she had had it. She was sober. We'd met in AA. I'd gone back out and started drinking, and she was done, man. And that's all I could say. But she took me back in, and I went through the whole process down here. But I decided I could drink again. And just a couple beers here and there, and I was trying to sneak it. And I was living a very miserable life, guys, you know. Try to go to meetings, and you could smell alcohol coming out of my pores. And I was miserable, absolutely miserable. And I didn't know what to do. And the last drink I had on January 14th, it wasn't like the groundbreaking, I wrapped my car around the pole and, you know, lost a wife and kids. My wife came up to me and said, you know, I can love you from afar. But, you know, and that was basically what she said, and somehow that sunk in. And I knew where AA was. I knew Lake of the Woods meetings. I knew I did have a network I could grab back onto. And thank God people took me back in, you know. And I'm definitely not the poster child for Alcoholics Anonymous, trust me. I took the rough road, but I am so grateful. I think I had to go through what I had to go through in order to be here tonight and stand up here and tell you guys my story. Some of the stuff that's been going on lately, God has put some amazing, amazing people in my life. And I get to discuss some things. One of the things that has been standing out to me is anonymity lately. And I think I had a discussion with you a couple weeks ago about where it is. You know, you hear people blast through the traditions, and at the end, you know, where anonymity is a spiritual foundation of our program. And I got to thinking about that, you know, and I questioned it before because I thought it was all about who you see here, what you see here, let it stay here. And then they read that blurb. And I wondered about that. And then you hear people talk about, oh, in a grocery store, you don't run across and say hello. And I started to think about the humility that comes with anonymity, because there's a different level to that today, in my understanding. And it's the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous, because we can always grow in here. And what I found is, for me, it means so much more. Anonymity is me talking one-on-one to another alcoholic, showing him all my warts and barnacles, and him sharing his with mine. And a lot of times it's those little car rides to a meeting, you know, or that phone call in the middle of the night. The whole meaning has changed. You know, you can go as deep into Alcoholics Anonymous as you want, but everything I have in my life today, I owe to this program. I've got a couple minutes to tell you guys another story that's happened to me since I've been sober. Does anybody remember the recession? Yeah. Well, we had some tough stuff happen. We lost a home during a recession. And we moved into, not by coincidence. My wife knew somebody, and their parents just so happened to have a lake house. And we moved right down the road from Scott and Shannon, if you guys know them. It was a lease. And it was so we could get our, you know, feet back on the ground. And we loved the house. It was right on Lake of the Woods. And, you know, we were involved, and all our neighbors, and involved with a lot of AA. But the folks had to sell this home. And we're dog people, man. We got a bunch of dogs. We got critters all over the place. Not many people let you in with critters, right? And it was humiliating enough for my gal, you know, to lose our home. But here we go again. You know, we're sober and we're going through all this stuff. See, sobriety doesn't guarantee that you're not going to go through stuff. I know most of you folks in this room, I've seen you go through some amazing stuff. So here's some stuff I've been through lately, we've been through, and God has been through with us. So we got to move out of this lake house. We don't know where we're going to go. I meet this guy from Culpeper, says, oh, yeah, I got a deal for you, and you can take your dogs. And that was like the highest thing, because we didn't want to get rid of our animals. We found ourselves sleeping in a basement that leaked on all our furniture. And the four unpainted walls, all sheetrock, nothing on the window. And I was like, oh, God, what does my wife think of me, you know? And every time it rained, it would be all over our furniture. We're lifting it up, putting 2x4s underneath it on the floor. But I'm getting to know you guys in Culpeper, you know? And you're getting to know me. And we're on this ride, and I'd met this guy in Lake of the Woods before I left. He actually helped me move a little bit. He said, man, why don't you buy my house? I was like, ah, that's out of my league, man. I got all these problems. No way. That'll ever happen. And so we're living in a crappy house, and it's falling apart. Well, maybe we got to buy it. There's really, you know, we're kind of not thinking very much of ourselves, but more of a desperate, fear-based buy, and because we need some place to live that'll let us have our animals and our life. And so we're almost in this deal with this guy, and the fellow from Lake of the Woods that's in AA calls us up, and he said, man, why don't you just move into my house, lease it for a while. If you like it, buy it. We'll talk about the money later. And I'm like, this guy is just persistent, you know? Because he had to move to North Carolina. He says, I really want somebody in my house. And so I broke my lease with the guy in Culpeper and moved into this fellow's house. I don't know if anybody else has experienced this, but for me, whenever I feel like I'm doing God's will to the best of my ability, I am not the square peg going through the round hole. I found with this program there are times when walls that were thought were impossible would drop right in front of you. The walls that you've been banging into for so long, and the things that you were thinking, this is a gift. And this guy made it possible. We bought the house last year. I married my wife last year. Just some incredible things have happened in our life. I'm employed. That's a great thing. I wasn't employed for a while during the recession. I didn't think anybody would ever fire the great Bob, but that happened too. So it's been a ride, you know, and that's what my recovery has looked like. It's kind of messy, but I'm grateful that I'm sober today, and then I can get up here and stand here and be able to share this with you guys. I'm so grateful that the doors work both ways in this room, you know. I'm so grateful for my life today. The people, the things that you guys share in here help me live. I did not know how to live before I came to AA. And here, everything I need. I don't try to complicate that anymore. I used to look for the outs in it, you know. Well, why doesn't this or why doesn't it work? Today, I don't even question it, man, because I see it in you guys. You give me hope. And we watch each other, and when we fall, we stumble, we pick each other up. And this is a life I don't want to trade for nothing, man. I don't. And I'm just grateful for you guys having me over here today and appreciate it. Thank you.